Land Podcast with David Amoyala.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the week of the CalcioLand podcast. So we're recording this on Friday morning. We're going to dedicate a lot of the podcast on all the changes at Roma. We have a game picks from our friend Thousand Names since the Serie A weekend is kicking off this afternoon. We, of course, have great Twitter questions from our listeners, and we're going to close the podcast an interview with my editor from The Athletic, Brooks Peck. I'm really excited by this one. If you remember, when we started CalcioLand, we focused a lot on writing, journalism. Every time we had a journalist, we talked a lot about their career. I've been getting a lot of questions on writing, so I think Brooks will be right up your alley. But before we get to all that, I'm joined by our great friend, co-host of the show, Alex Goldberg. So, Alex, I don't want to talk too much about the Roma game. A lot happened since. So I'm going to ask you simply, what was your reaction to Di Francesco being sacked? Were you surprised? Do you think maybe it's a little bit too little, too late? What was your reaction in general with all the changes?
Yeah, so off the bat, was I surprised? No, but definitely me not being surprised plays into my answer here and my genuine reaction feeling about all of this. First off, I just have to say that I said this before the season started, I believe. I'm pretty sure it was when you asked me to make the top six predictions that I like Di Francesco. I think highly of Di Francesco, but I really feel like he was put in a very, very tough position. I've said countless times that that team, Roma, is really not constructed very well. A lot of good players, a lot of good young players, and a lot of good veterans. But I just feel like it was kind of a Mr. Potato Head, just a random assortment of parts, not really designed to be cohesive and have continuity. So I'm not saying he was set up to fail, but he was not necessarily set up to succeed. So I feel like this is a little bit unfair on him, but I understand that's just kind of what you get into being a manager, especially at a top club like Roma. And he's not blameless. He's certainly not blameless, but I kind of feel bad for him. But further, is it too little too late? I think it kind of is, because in my opinion, Roma knew that this could happen for a while. We've all talked about this for a while. We had a feeling that Di Francesco could be sacked for a while. So obviously Roma did. So really, if it took this Champions League loss for him to get sacked, then shouldn't you have just done it earlier? Shouldn't you have just done it earlier? In my opinion, you should have. So in my opinion, it should have happened either earlier when there was more to salvage, or it shouldn't have happened at all this season. So I just don't like how it all went down. And I just think that although Di Francesco is not blameless, he's not blameless, I just feel like he was given a really, really tough situation right off the bat. So I think there are many more people to blame than just Di Francesco. So that's my immediate reaction, David. What did you make of Roma's elimination specifically and the sacking as well?
Yeah, so well said, Alex. You definitely weren't a prisoner of the moment with your take on Roma and Di Francesco. You had them sixth going into the season. I think I had them fifth, but I saw a lot of the same issues as you. So let's talk really quickly about the elimination in the Champions League, because I think it does tie into Di Francesco as well. I thought it was kind of ironic that you know, the two main players responsible for the elimination were Dzeko, who has been Roma's hero in the Champions League, usually does really well. He failed to score an extra time, could have gotten them past the round. And then we had Florenzi, the captain in waiting, causing the foul on the penalty. I think, you know, the only player that really stood out in a positive way was De Rossi, who really played like a captain. Even post-match, you know, as usual, he carried himself as you would expect. Now, you know, Di Francesco, I think, you know, in the back of Roma's mind, one of the reasons maybe why they didn't do the sacking sooner is we know he's done well in Europe. Roma needs all the revenues that they can get. Maybe they felt they had a better chance of making it to the quarterfinals, and maybe, who knows, get lucky again in the draw, get breaks, go their way, maybe make it even an extra round. So I think in a way that maybe delayed the change. I think had he been eliminated in the group stage, he would have been gone much sooner, because in Serie A they did underachieve. Now, I completely agree with you that he's not the main person responsible, and we'll get more to Monchi in a second now that his departure from the club is official. I mean, you look at the defense. DeFrancesco, other than Manolas, really had no one that he could count on. I always like to say you go from Manolas, the other center backs on Roma, it's like listening to Queen with Freddie Mercury and listening to Queen with Adam Lambert. I mean, that's a huge drop-off after Manolas. Marcano, who hadn't played really all season, was started in this match. I thought, you know, putting Zaniolo on the wing, that's one thing where maybe you can give a blame to DeFrancesco. He hasn't really strived in that role. So I think the Champions League was really in the back of Roma's mind, but maybe that's going to cost them not qualifying for the Champions League next season. And that's ultimately much more important for Roma. I know there are financial advantages every time they pass around. But now Roma really, the silver lining, if you're a Roma fan, now they can just focus on finishing in the top four. They have a pretty decent chance. They have a tough schedule, but so do all the other teams. So definitely a fascinating situation there, and we'll get into it even more with the Twitter questions.
Yeah, so obviously, David, the Roma news doesn't stop there. Monchi is now gone from Roma as well. So how would you rate his time at Roma?
So, you know, when it comes to managers, sporting directors, things like that, I think the best way is very simply you ask yourself, are they leaving the organization in better shape than they found it? And I think it's very hard to argue that Monchi, against the fact that Monchi is leaving Roma in worse shape than he found them. Now, I know they made the Champions League semifinal last year. They finished, in the top four. So last season was a resounding success, but that was mainly with players that were there before. Monchi had arrived. Allison was already on the club. I think the only really significant player that he had brought in was Cengiz Under, of those that helped him last season. The rest was really from his predecessors. I think at the end of the day, if you want to rate Monchi's time at Roma, you take the Zaniolo deal out. That was a huge home run. There really isn't too much that you can hang your hat on as positive. I think Kolarov was a good signing, but that's really not a Monchi type signing. This is a veteran player who helped Roma. You look at a lot of the other younger players that he tried to bring in. It's really a mixed bag. I mean, Karsdorp's been better recently, but he did struggle with injury. Patrick Schick has been better in 2019, but overall, he has been a bust. Some of the other veterans, like Pastore, look, we can give him a ton of credit for the Zaniolo Nainggolan deal, which to me is clearly his best deal at Roma. And look, just Zaniolo, that really goes a long way towards his legacy. But the flip side of that deal is all the money he got for Nainggolan as part of that deal was reinvested in Pastore, and that hasn't gone well. I think Nzonzi has been a mixed bag. He arrived, we knew he would take him a while because he was in the deep run with France in the World Cup. I think he's been okay, not great. But again, this is an older player they invested a lot in, and they needed bigger dividends. So I think overall, if you had to give a grade to Monchi at Roma, I think it's hard to give him anything more than a C-, and that might be pretty generous. Now, there's a lot to be said. I think Roma, and I know I tweeted this morning, and I got a lot of pushback. To me, there's no job in Serie A with more pressure than Roma. And I know, people point to Juve, Milan, Inter. It's just very different because of the makeup of the city. In Totti's book, he used to tell his teammates after a loss, just don't go out, don't go clubbing, don't go out to restaurants after a loss because people will be pissed. And his teammates were all really shocked about this. There's pressure at Inter and Milan, but fans do not show up at the airport to insult the players or even show up at the training facility to wait for the team bus after a tough loss to throw rocks at them and really try to intimidate them. It's a completely different place. I think some people confuse having a lot of attention and spotlight on a club. It's one thing to have a lot of people tweeting about it or making videos and whatnot, but it's one thing if someone made a video about me and a whole other thing if someone shows up at my house after I had a bad day or a bad podcast at my job to confront me about it. You want to add to that also the fact that Roma is in a tough financial situation, even beyond financial fair play. So I think if you're Monchi, just because he didn't do well at Roma doesn't mean that he can't do well elsewhere in a less pressure situation. As it stands now, and again, it's early, we're recording this Friday morning, Arsenal does look like the likeliest destination. And I know there's a lot of fans, a lot of pressure there as well, but it's different type of pressure there. He'd be have his connection with Emery. I actually could see him doing quite well there. So though, if you want to judge his time at Roma, you can't really give him a great grade, but I'm going to say that he can do quite well in his next role. And as of now, it sounds like Arsenal is the likeliest destination.
All right. Well, what a week it was for Roma. But now let's look ahead to the weekend in Serie A. You're back. Of course, it was great last week to read your predictions and Thousand Names predictions, but it definitely is a little bit better and authentic when you do it, David. So without further ado, what are our game picks from you and Thousand Names?
Okay, so Juve fans, this week you catch a break. Thousand didn't want to pick the Juve match. We're recording this Friday morning, but I'm sure he's predicting that Ronaldo will miss a penalty. I think that doesn't change. But let's start. First match, he sent me Sassuolo at home against Napoli. Thousand has Napoli winning 1-0, goal by Milik. The comment is that De Zerbi is once again going to get smacked around in an important match, and that Ancelotti is going to get his revenge on what happened against Juve, which he described as a furto, as a robbery. So Ancelotti is going to get revenge on the robbery against Juve, and that Berardi is going to be ridiculous, but not in a good way. In Italian, Sassuolo Napoli, Milik, De Zerbi ancora preso schiaffi in una partita importante, Ancelotti vendica il furto della Juve, Berardi ridicolo. I'm going to agree with Thousand. I think Napoli is going to have a good reaction. By the way, kudos to Napoli. Excellent win in the Europa League yesterday. I think it's great that Ancelotti is going all in that competition. I think despite that match, they'll still win. And guess what? I'm going to agree with Thousand. I'm going to go give a goal to Milik, which I have to say, I'm still shocked that there's so many Napoli fans that are looking for upgrades at the striker position. That is not where I would invest. I think Milik is really terrific. So I'm going to agree with Thousand. We both have Napoli winning 1-0 with a goal by Milik. Next match, we have Inter at home against Spal. And he has Inter winning 1-0 with a goal by Lautaro Martinez. And he says that Icardi is going to be taken out of the team from the Croatian players on the team. And he says that Marotta is destroying Inter, but thank God there's lucky Luciano Spalletti to bring some good luck and change the narrative. In Italian, Inter-Spal 1-0, Lautaro Martinez, Icardi fatto fuori ancora dai croati, Marotta sta distruggendo l'Inter, meno male che c'è lucky Luciano. I'm going to agree again with Thousand, but I'm going to have Inter winning 2-0. I'm going to give a goal to Lautaro Martinez and Politano as well. Last match, and we changed this one. He had it send me the Roma-Empoli one before all the changes. He originally had Roma-Empoli as a 1-1 draw, but I guess Thousand is in favor of the managerial change. The updated prediction is Roma defeating Empoli 3-0. He says Empoli striker Caputo sbaglia rigore. You guys know what that means. He says Zaniolo is going to score a brace and El Shaarawy is going to score. And he says you can already see Ranieri's impact and that Di Francesco had buried the team. And he did say that Empoli's defense is a disgrace, which is something we've talked about in the podcast before. In Italian, Roma Empoli 3-0. Caputo sbaglia rigore, Zaniolo doppietta, El Shaarawy, già si vede la mano di Ranieri, Di Francesco ha affossato questa squadra, difesa Empoli vergognosa. I hate to agree with Thousand on all three, but I'm going to do the same. I do like Empoli of the teams in the race to avoid relegation. They are clearly the one I want to stay up, but I do agree that Roma is going to have a reaction with Ranieri. So those are our picks. As always, it's been a little while. I love when our listeners tweet us their picks as well under the tweet. So if you're interested, this would be a good week because Thousand and I are on the same page on all three. So one thing, Alex, that I think you and I are on the same page is how great the questions are that we get from our listeners. As always, you can send questions on Serie A, transfers, TV, music, film, journalism using the CalcioLand hashtag. So, Alex, which ones are we going to go over today?
All right, David, let's start off with something very topical. What did you make of Roma appointing Claudio Ranieri to replace Di Francesco?
Well, I think Roma caught a big break with Paulo Sousa agreeing to go to Bordeaux over Roma. I always say, you know, easy to sack the manager, harder to find someone better. And I think Ranieri has a chance to be a much better appointment than Di Francesco. So the first way I would describe this appointment is selfless. I give a lot of credit to Ranieri for how he handled it. Now, Ranieri is from the city of Rome. He played for Roma. That was his first team as a professional. He managed Roma 10 years ago, and he's a big Romanista. It's not just an act. And he agreed to coach Roma with no guarantee for next season. As my friend, as Di Marzio reported, and he's very close to Ranieri, Ranieri really insisted that there be no guarantees, that he was really just there to help Roma. I think Ranieri sees it that if he gets them to the Champions League, maybe they can get someone better long term, maybe a long term manager. So I really respect his decision for how he handles it. I think as a man to man, that was very nice. And I think, you know, maybe he can have an impact in Serie A. I'm curious to see how he does, but I'm cautiously optimistic on this hire, especially because it's not Paulo Sousa coming in.
All right. Next question, David. Who deserves more blame for Roma's elimination between Monchi and Di Francesco?
Yeah, I think almost everyone would agree that it's Monchi deserves much more of the blame here. I think you were spot on with the analysis. I actually am a fan of Di Francesco as a manager, too. I'd really like to see him get a chance at a place like Fiorentina, Sampdoria. I could see him doing really well there. I think, look, Monchi, more than anything, you can really point to the defense as being a huge problem. I was okay with him selling Nainggolan and Strootman. That made sense to me. I thought Nzonzi on paper made sense. I had heard a lot of great things on Zaniolo. I never expected him to be that great, which he has been. Cristante exceeded my expectations, but overall the cupboard was bare. But I do respect, though, Monchi as well leaving with Di Francesco. He said they were basically tied at the hip. I think he felt responsible for the team that he built. So I respect that as well, that they both left. But I think Di Francesco actually leaves Roma looking better than Monchi. But again, also different situation. Di Francesco was very familiar with the vibe at Roma. He had played there. Monchi, I think, didn't realize the insane pressure there. So it's possible that Monchi does really well in his next role, and I hope Di Francesco as well.
All right, how about this? Should Roma consider their exit in the round of 16 of the Champions League an underachievement? Do you think there is such a thing as a Champions League DNA?
So no, I don't think Roma should see it as a underachievement in the round of 16. Now, look, the Champions League, it's the luck of the draw, right? Porto on paper were probably the easiest team they could face. So there is disappointment there. But when you look at Roma and the landscape of the teams in Europe, and I hate bringing up revenues and all, I think that's kind of where they are, you know, a top 16 team in Europe. I think that's maybe even a little bit higher than what they are. You know, it's interesting to me that I saw a lot of people tweeting that Roma embarrassed themselves in Italy by going out and they don't have Champions League DNA. And I completely disagree with that. I think Roma, the reason they were able to face Porto and they had a fairly easy group this season is because of their success last year. They deserve a lot of credit for what they did last year. Let's not forget that last year Roma was in the group of death in the Champions League. They not only qualified, they won it outright. Then they took out Barcelona. So they made it to the semifinal, and that helped them in their ranking. Let's compare that to Napoli. They've been out of the Champions League in the group stage 2 years in a row. Roma got out of the group 2 years in a row. And look, we know the first year on the Sarri, maybe that was by design with Napoli, but they didn't pass this year, and that wasn't their goal. You look at Inter, they were in a group of death. They have higher revenues, higher payrolls. They didn't get out of that group. So I think there's been a lot of hot takes on Roma, just based prisoner of the moment things on Porto. But when you look at the context, I think Roma has to be really proud of what they've done in the Champions League. You know, it's not just their social media team, which they do a fantastic job. It's also their success in the Champions League. And as far as, you know, there being a Champions League DNA, I think, you know, there are some clubs that prioritize Europe over Italy or over domestic league in general. I think there's definitely something to be said about that. There are clubs that, you know, maybe on the big stage in Europe choke a little bit more than others, PSG, Juve, as well. But I think it's just too easy to just chalk it up to that. To me, it always depends on the players you have on the pitch at the time, the manager that you have. But the club's philosophy does have something to do with that. Look, Milan, rightfully so, has a great Champions League DNA because of their history, and they've always prioritized Europe over Italy. But let's also be honest, the last two times they've been in the Champions League, they were eliminated in the round of 16. And I know they had tough opponents, but so did Roma last year in the quarterfinal, and they took out Barca. So I think we need to look at a little bit in the context. And I think Roma's been getting a little bit beat up too much over what happened against Porto.
All right, good friend of the State of Play pod, Petri Berisha asks, what can we expect in the summer transfer window from Roma?
As always, man, Roma is always one of the most fascinating teams in Serie A. Oh, them and Inter, I think, always give us great content. So as of now, Roma went with an internal promotion. Frederick Massara has taken over for Monchi. Makes sense. He was Sabatini's right-hand man as well before. They've been grooming him for a while. I have a feeling it's going to be a little bit of a triumvirate. I know they want to give Totti a little bit more responsibility, and Totti was learning a lot from Monchi. Curious to see how that fits, that dynamic. I could imagine Totti maybe having more loyalty to the current players. Maybe it'll help keep the players if the finance it permitted. And I also think Balzaretti, who also has been a director at Roma, is going to be in the mix as well. Now, if I was at Roma, I would go for Corvina from Fiorentina. I think he'd be a natural fit there. But if they go with the internal route, I think it's going to be kind of this triumvirate. It's going to be very interesting to see how they handle the transfer window. I think, look, a lot really comes down to if they make the Champions League or not. That's going to have a huge impact on what the team looks like next season. So let's see what happens there. I think Zeko's future is tied to that. Be curious to see what else happened. Now, Roma is going to be in better shape with financial fair play. I think they get out of the parameters altogether, but they still carry huge debt. So I wouldn't expect them to be huge spenders, but I'm curious to see if their approach changes that much. I would imagine with Massara being in the mix, unless he's replaced, though, that it will be pretty similar to what we've seen in recent years.
All right, this is an interesting question, David. Is the Champions League a good way to gauge how strong the domestic leagues are?
So, Alex, as I answer, start thinking about this because I'm curious of your take. I don't know. I think a little bit, but I also think it very, really much varies year to year a lot, and it's very easy to cherry pick. I think, you know, it has a lot to do, too, with luck of draws and whatnot, and even how it's designed, how you can meet teams from the same league in the earlier rounds or whatnot. So I definitely think there's something to be said about that. But if we went strictly on the domestic league, on how you do in Europe, and I'll even put the Europa League, you would say that La Liga is clearly the best league. Because, you know, Barcelona, Real Madrid won so many times. Barcelona won recently. Atletico in the Europa League. But again, maybe that league is top heavy. This is my opinion. I'm not a huge expert. So does that really say that the whole league is really strong? So I don't know. I think there's a lot of factors. You know me in general. I hate comparing leagues. But I think this is kind of somewhat of an objective way to compare leagues, maybe more than just certainly more than personal opinion. But I just think there's more than meets the eye. And again, maybe a league's top heavy and not that great overall. So that's my take. I'm curious to see what you think, Alex.
Yeah, and I'm going to pick my words wisely here and I'm going to be careful. But the one thing I will say is I think it does show the lack of quality in Liga. I'm not going to touch the other leagues, but considering what's happening with PSG, who obviously have so many damn good players, considering every year they seem to find a way to bottle it or fall flat on their face, I really think what that says, David, is they're just not getting enough heightened experience. They're not getting enough extreme pressurized situations in Liga, and they just look like they're not fully prepared when it really gets when it really gets good, when it really gets into a nerve-wracking situation, I feel like they're just not being tested enough in Ligue 1. So I do agree with you. I think for all the other leagues, it can kind of change year to year, and it's not an even playing field either with scheduling and everything. So the one league I will say maybe it does say a lot about is Ligue 1, because I think PSG, if they were playing in maybe a more competitive league, they'd be more well-equipped for these heightened situations in the Champions League. That's what I'll say. So the next Twitter question is from Milan Weekly Pod, and they ask, should UEFA hire an independent company to handle VAR?
Great question. And I know John Solano, by the way, huge shout out to the amazing work he's done covering all the stuff going on at Roma recently. I know John says that it shouldn't be the referee of the match that reviews the VAR. There should be kind of an independent legal office that views them kind of in a vacuum. And I think that's an intriguing idea. So it sounds like Milan Weekly Pod is kind of trying to apply that same concept to all of UEFA. Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot to be said about that. I think VAR, the first year in Serie A, I thought it was quite good. I feel like this year it's just created more controversy. And I know it's happened in La Liga as well. It's happening in Europe. So I think it needs to be changed. There needs to be, you know, either someone other than the referee reviewing it. I also would be in favor of coaches at least having one challenge themselves. I think it's almost more controversial as what's reviewed and what's not than the actual decisions. So definitely something needs to change. But I have a feeling because there's been so much complaining, hopefully it will happen.
All right, this is a mouthful. David, who will be the managers of Juve, Roma, Inter, Milan, Lazio, Sampdoria, and Atalanta next year?
This is our friend John Lamorte is putting me on the spot. So I'll tell you, I feel like there's two variables, and it's the last two teams that he mentioned. It's just Sampdoria and Atalanta. Because I feel Gasperini and Giampaolo, those are the managers in Serie A that are the most ready to take the next step and coach a bigger team. I could see either of them coaching Roma next season. I'd really be a big fan of Gasperini at Roma, but I could see Giampaolo doing well there as well. So we need to see what happens with Roma. Look, maybe Ranieri has a great end of the season and they can't help but put him as the manager there. So I'm just going to take some guesses, educated guesses on these. I'm going to go Juve. Gun to the head, I would say Zidane, if I had to bet. Gun to the head, Roma. I'm going to say Gasperini. Inter, I'm going to say Conte. Milan, Gattuso has to stay. I'm going to guess Lazio. Either Inzaghi stays, and I know we have a question later on this. I wouldn't be surprised if Sarri is at Lazio. Sampdoria and Atalanta, if their managers leave, I could see De Zerbi from Sassuolo managing one of those two. That would be my guess. So great question, John. This was really me trying to answer. Don't put, you know, don't write a Daily Star or whatever tabloid. David said this is going to happen. This is just gun to the head. These would be my guesses.
And let's not pretend I didn't hear you mention Maurizio Sarri in that answer. All right. Next question, David. Are you in favor of demolishing the San Siro and building a new stadium for Milan and Inter?
I'm completely against this. I completely against it. I look at their stadiums in Europe, the Santiago Bernabeu, the Old Trafford, Anfield, like stadiums like that, that they're historic, they can be renovated. I'm completely in favor of renovating San Siro. Look, you know, on TV, it still looks great. It's a great facility. You don't have to worry of having the athletic ramp around that creates distance and looks horrible on television. I've always said it. To me, it seems every time talk of San Siro being replaced, that's always like a strategy by clubs, either a diversion strategy or bring attention to their management. So I'm completely against it. If you've been at San Siro, it definitely needs some renovations besides what you see on television, but I think it needs to stay. So I have a question for you, Alex. One of our listeners asks, when will you just bite the bullet and become a Milan fan, Alex?
Well, you know, they're clearly listening because I think recently, anytime I've talked glowingly about a team on Calcioland, it's definitely been Milan. Oh, man, it's taken a while, hasn't it? Really has. I've had my favorite players like Lorenzo Insigne and Alessandro, but I've just never committed to any of those clubs. And right now, from a team perspective, yeah, Milan's got me going. This whole Paqueta, Bakayoko, Kessie, Piontek thing is really fun to watch. But I got to be selfish here. I just think they still need to acquire maybe a player that I previously like at a different club. So I said, David, while you were gone, if they got someone like Thorgan Hazard, Eden Hazard's brother, or I know there were rumors a year ago for David Neres of Ajax, who played great in the Champions League this past week. I think it would just take one player, just one player that I even remotely like outside of Milan, and then I will commit to Milan. But they are the team that I'm closest to committing on. I really like what they got going on, and I appreciate the question. So next question, are Arsenal a bigger club than Juve, as Tony Adams suggested?
Long and short of it, no. And I think this isn't just because I cover Serie A. I think any kind of objective person, you just match them up in almost any category that you want. It's kind of hard to lean Arsenal. I know some people that tweeted me, well, what do you expect from an Arsenal captain? Would you expect them to say anything else? Well, I'll tell you, I certainly wouldn't expect Del Piero. I certainly wouldn't expect Buffon. I wouldn't expect Deschamps or some of the older Juve captains to say that Juve is bigger than Real Madrid. So no, long and short of it, I love all our Premier League listeners and all, but I've never seen like players, fans and all such an obsession to always say bigger, better and whatnot. Just, you know, enjoy what you like. But objectively speaking, I'd have a very hard time saying that Arsenal's bigger than Juve.
All right. Next question comes from Kane K. If Chelsea end up sacking Maurizio Sarri, do you see him managing at Roma or somewhere else in Serie A?
So, Alex, I'm going to be curious before I answer that. While I answer this, I want to get your think about if you think there's more momentum for Sarri staying. You're much more plugged into Chelsea than I am. But from where I'm sitting, it seems like maybe there's a chance. But I'll tell you, if he returns to Serie A, and selfishly, I want him to do well. I want him to be happy. So if that's Chelsea, great. But me, selfishly, I'd love to have him back in Serie A. I've always seen Roma as kind of an odd fit because of the pressure there. So he was at Napoli, huge pressure. At Chelsea, because of all the chaos at the club, it hasn't been an easy going. I'm not sure if Roma would be at the top of the list for his next job. Also because of the contentious rivalry between Napoli and Roma, and he is from Naples and has affection to the club. I've said it before, to me the team that makes the most sense for him would be Lazio. I also could see Fiorentina with their style of play, and he has a lot of ties to Tuscany as well. So those would be my two guesses. But let me ask you briefly, Alex, if you had to put a percentage, what percentage do you think Sarri next season at Chelsea?
Damn. Wow. I feel like my percentage would change every day, especially in the last 2 weeks. Right now, 50%. 50%. If you asked me a few weeks ago, especially before the Carabao Cup final against Manchester City, I would have said 20%, because it seemed like if they had just had one more bad loss, he really would have been out the door. I would say right now he is making the board at Chelsea a little bit happier, especially with the results. And I think if Chelsea do qualify for Champions League next year, and they have two ways of doing that, I think the chances definitely go up, but the chances significantly go down if they're not in the Champions League next year. So I would say 50% as of right now. But David, you know, this is Chelsea. The manager could be gone tomorrow for all we know. So who knows? Yeah. But it's a damn good question. All right. So the next question, David, comes from Art Morelli, and he asks, just put together a concert of three bands that you know you would never normally be able to see together.
So at first, I was tempted to put artists that are dead that I never had a chance to see. So, you know, Jimi Hendrix, something like his band, or, you know, Queen with Freddie Mercury, which were a little bit before my time, something like that, or the Beatles, their original lineup. But I'm going to go with bands that I have seen live and that are part, a big part of the soundtrack to my life, but I'd like to hear them in a different phase of their career. So I would have loved to see Motley Crue in the early 80s in a club in Los Angeles. So not an arena, just like the Whiskey or the Troubadour, something like that, just to get a vibe for what that would have been like. LA in that time with Motley Crue. Then I would have loved to see Pink Floyd in the 70s with Gilmore and Roger Waters together. Maybe the Wall Tour or something like that. I've seen Roger Waters many times. I've seen David Gilmour live. I would have loved to see them together, though, in that era of Pink Floyd. Staying on the 70s, I'm still going to pick Van Halen in the 70s. I've seen them with David Lee Roth, not that long ago, but I really would have liked to see them back then before they were signed. I've heard a lot of their bootlegs, seen some videos, but that's one band that I would have really enjoyed to see live in that phase of their career.
All right, David, last Twitter question comes from Juan Sebastian, and he asks, who are the best frontmen in rock's history? My pick is Freddie Mercury, and I would have said that even before the Bohemian Rhapsody craze.
So good shout. I think Freddie Mercury is a great shout. And this is going to actually, I'm going to very quickly give my take on the Oscars. I rewatched Bohemian Rhapsody on the plane to Jamaica. And as much as I liked Rami Malek and I thought his performance was very good, it's really a travesty that he won the Oscar on that. I mean, it really was mainly for the parts where he was lip syncing and it was great and all. But compared to what Christian Bale did as Dick Cheney, that's like a completely different sport. I also just recently rewatched the Doors movie where Val Kilmer is actually singing the songs himself. So my opinion of Rami Malek's performance has changed quite a bit. But back to the question. I think Freddie Mercury is a great shout. You can like Queen or not, and I know to some people they can be a pretty corny band. I'm not in that camp, but there's few people that were born to do anything as much as Freddie Mercury was to be a frontman. The stuff in the 70s, but his performance at Live Aid, and I know that's the big scene in Bohemian Rhapsody, but just go watch the original. It's really remarkable. There's really no one who was really put on the surf to do that as much, anything as much as he was for that. So he's a great choice. The other one that I would say, is Mick Jagger. To me, the longevity, like Freddie Mercury, to his advantage too, for his legacy, is he checked out young. We just remember him really in his prime. Mick Jagger is still amazing now. I saw the Stones 5-6 years ago. He was close to 70, still an incredible frontman. And two, when you think about it, Mick Jagger really created the bad boy image of rock and roll, him and Keith Richards with the Stones. The Beatles were the great pop rock band, but the Stones really set the blueprint for the rock and roll band. So I would say Jagger. Robert Plant, you can make a great shout. He also set a blueprint for the hard rock frontman. I will say, though, of those that I saw in their primes, the ones that really stand out to me that I saw, Axl Rose in the early 90s, the danger that came with rock and roll. You don't know if there was going to be a riot, a great concert, when he would show up. Like, I kind of missed that era of rock and roll. To me, it's kind of a shame that now, the bad part of Guns N' Roses being on tour is now you just see this fat version of Axl who can't really sing anymore. But back in the day, he was incredible. And the last one, I don't know, you saw him too, is Eddie Vedder, just for the presence that he has. Obviously he's a great singer, still his baritone still sounds great, but there's just something about being in the same stadium or arena with him, the aura that he has. So of those that I saw in their prime, it's Axl Rose and Eddie Vedder, but historically I think it has to come down to Mick Jagger and Freddie Mercury. So now let's close. We're going to move away from both calcio and music and touch upon the other thing that we cover on Calcio Land, and this is journalism and writing. So I invited my editor from The Athletic, Brooks Peck. I've done a lot of my best work really is thanks to him. So I know get a lot of questions from writers who ask me, how can I get better at writing? How can I, break out in this field? So I couldn't think of anyone better than Brooks. So I think you'll really enjoy this interview. I think if you produce any sort of content, YouTube videos, articles, or even just tweets, I think you'll enjoy this interview. And we look forward to chatting with you guys next week with two new episodes. And for the interview part of the podcast, I really couldn't think of anyone better to bring on as we start the next 200 episodes of Calcio Land than one of my editors at The Athletic. And I like to call him a magician because he turns what I send him into my best columns. And this is Brooks Peck. So he's been at The Athletic, I think, for about a year. I think he joined last summer. He's the co-founder of a blog that I was reading last night, The Dirty Tackle. formerly worked at Yahoo Sports and the excellent magazine, What a Howler. So, Brooks, it's a real pleasure to finally speak to you. We've had a lot of conversations via email, Google Docs, so it's a real pleasure to welcome you to Couchland.
Yeah, same here, David. I'm glad to be here. And congrats on the 200th episode, by the way.
All right. Thank you so much. So as I mentioned, Brooks is an editor. And, you know, I have to say, you know, I've been writing for a while, but I've never had someone that really gave me great feedback on my articles and helped me improve. So the purpose of this interview is a lot of you guys often ask me, of all people, you know, advice, questions on columns. I have people sending me articles asking me to give them feedback on it, which Brooks probably finds really, really frightening. So I wanted to have someone that actually does this for a living and that can really share with you guys some great tips. But before we get to that, Brooks, I want to talk a little bit about The Athletic. So, you know, a lot of my listeners aren't based in the U.S., so I'm going to give a brief description of what the site is like, and then I'd like you to describe it to someone that doesn't know anything about it. So,
sure.
The Athletic covers all sorts of sports in the U.S., you know, the NBA, NFL, baseball, hockey, all that good stuff. And they started covering, the site's been around for a few years. They have great writers and really A-list writers. Don't let the fact that I write for it be kind of a barometer for what the site is like. They really have the top writers for the American sports. And for Serie A, you know, we have Paolo Condò, who's one of the best writers, Paolo Bandini, who's also been on both of them have been on the podcast. The soccer page really grown. It's really great content. So, you know, it's a subscription-based site. It's more long-form articles. I like to describe it's really not about clickbait and trying to get people to read something, you know, maybe in a deceiving manner. We cover a lot of really interesting topics. So that's kind of how I would describe it. Brooks, what would you add or how would you explain what The Athletic is to someone who doesn't know anything about it?
Yeah, well, first of all, you're far too self-deprecating, David. Your work is some of the best that we have. So don't sell yourself short. But I think you did a great job of really giving the overview. And the best way to describe this site is as the field of dreams for sports journalism, because it's kind of this mythical site that we never really thought would ever exist, in that there's no clickbait, there's no kind of deceptive tactics, you know, headlines or anything to try and draw people in under false pretenses. And the guys who created the site really give us freedom to do what we need to do, you know, to do our best work. And there's no, like, you know, hard deadlines. There's no real rules, basically. We're kind of just growing this as we see fit and doing it the right way and putting the work ahead of all else. And we really can't ask for anything more than that.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. And in a little bit, we're going to get into the types of articles that you pick, because you and I often bounce around different ideas, the timing of when to write it. And that's its own real fascinating topic. But I'd like to get into a little bit your story, because this is something I like to do with first-time guests, is give our listeners a little bit of background on to who we have on, and I think it's going to make a lot of sense why. So, you know, I've gotten to know you more in the past few months. I was reading about your career yesterday. So tell me a little bit how you got started covering, and we'll call it soccer since we're both here in the U.S. now, covering the sport, and what steps you took to get to where you are.
Well, believe it or not, my first writing gigs were about baseball and professional golf. So it's quite different from what I'm doing now. But my first job out of college was doing written commentary for a professional golf event. And when the company I was doing that for went out of business, my cousin and I started our own blog, Dirty Tackle, just independently on our own. And within about a year, it built up a nice sized audience. It was primarily humor based and oddball stories and our own, you know, invented fictional conversations and stuff like that. So it built up an audience as being just something different than what was out there at the time. And after about a year, Yahoo Sports decided they didn't need to cover soccer. They didn't have a soccer blog at the time, even though they did for just about every other major sport. And they bought 30 Tackle. So I joined Yahoo around 2009, 2010, and wrote for them for 5 or 6 years, just doing Dirty Tackle for them and kind of expanding the scale of it and covering more and doing bigger things. And then after Yahoo, I joined George Qureshi at Howler Magazine and ran their website for a couple of years, continuing Dirty Tackle and doing a podcast for that. And then when George came over to The Athletic, he brought me with him. And so we've been at The Athletic since April of last year.
Wow. Very interesting. So tell me a little bit, you know, like I mentioned, you're an editor. So again, don't really think of me. Think of, you know, people like Paolo Bandini and a lot of guys that used to write for Grantland. And, you know, there's really some very prestigious writers on the site and you're working with them to make them better. So tell me a little bit some of the lessons you learned along the way to get to this point in your career.
I mean, I think the biggest key is just to be unique, be original, have a unique voice, and do things differently than what everybody else is doing out there. That's the best way, the best advice I could give. It's the best way to do things, just to try and stand out. Find niches in the market that aren't being covered and need more attention, and fill those roles. You know, throughout my career, just trying to do things differently has been what sustained me. And I really kind of credit it all to that.
Yeah, very interesting because, you know, I'm an avid reader and I've kind of taken bits and pieces from different writers that I liked. And I noticed, you know, nobody's doing this in soccer. And I put this in air quotes on this podcast and all. And you got to really try to find the unique voice and try to be different. And I think, you know, I really like what you said, too. It's also a matter of becoming like a subject matter expert in a field where maybe there's not a lot of coverage. Like, you know, I've used the transfers as kind of like my thing, but then it gave me an opportunity to write on a bunch of other things. And yeah, I really enjoyed reading the articles on your other site yesterday because they're really quite unique. I'd never really seen anything quite like it with a sense of humor like that. So I want to ask you a little bit about the current landscape in sports content, and you've been doing this for a while, and I would imagine it's changed a lot since when you started, even before this decade, which is already coming to an end. So, you know, right now I feel like, you know, between the attention spans of people shortening, people, you know, don't even really want to click on a link on a tweet. They want everything to be put on a tweet thread, the era of podcasting, and I'm guilty of this. You know, I used to be a really avid reader, and now I catch myself listening to more podcasts than reading less. My co-host, Alex Goldberg, you know, his YouTube channel is doing great. So I feel like the landscape's really changed. And I have to say, you know, it's really refreshing since I've been on The Athletic to kind of get back into reading the articles like I used to read when there were still newspapers. So tell me a little bit how you think the long form article fits in this landscape and how you think The Athletic, you know, brings something maybe a little bit unique into the market, something that maybe was around before, but not so much anymore.
Sure. Well, when I started, I think it was much more about short form content and, you know, blogs and short, quick posts, just to give people a lot of different variety and different things and kind of keep things moving. But I feel like that really got oversaturated and too many people started doing it. So people kind of just got tired of it. And so now long form has kind of become the more unique, you know, style of doing things. And since it's more substantial, especially for a subscription site like The Athletic, it's something that we can, you know, actually charge money for people to read, and people are willing to pay for that because it has more depth to it and there's more, you know, there's more meat to it. So I feel like that's right now, that's kind of where things are. You know, long form is where value is in written content. There's always going to be, you know, video and audio and and a need for that and a desire to have that. But I think there's also going to be a desire for written content too. So right now it's long form. And I feel like, you know, eventually people will tire of that and there'll be something else. They'll be going back to shorter form stuff. But for now, that's where things are. And that's what we're really kind of hanging our hat on right now at the Athletic, is doing really strong quality, high quality, long form stuff that other sites might not have the resources to invest in single pieces and really go, you know, all the way on a single piece or single subject matter in a way that other people aren't.
Yeah, I think specifically it was one of the probably the best article I read on the site was the story on Mike Chiazza buying the team in lower divisions in Italy and his experience there. And you had the writer go to Italy and interview the Piazzas. I mean, it's very rare to get that stuff anywhere else. So it's very encouraging in a way to hear that there's still a market like that, because sometimes I get really pretty discouraged just seeing, you know, how people want as condensed as possible the information. And a lot of times it becomes the telephone game. They take information from a site, condense it in a tweet, yeah, and half the time it's wrong. So it's really encouraging to hear that there's a market for this. So I want to ask you a little bit more of your day-to-day job. So I would imagine, kind of like me, you have a lot of writers pitching you ideas. And, you know, I've written quite a few articles that you've edited, but there's been, you know, a good amount that you said, maybe not now, or this doesn't make sense, maybe let's do it this way. So tell me a little bit, what are the factors that you consider when someone like me pitches you a story?
I think the two biggest factors are, is this something that I would want to read myself? You know, would it hold the attention of a reader and grab grab their interest and you know, would it is it worth our time? And two, it's is this something different? Have I seen something similar to this somewhere else? Especially being a subscription site, we really have to differentiate our content and prove why we're charging for our subscription. So doing different things is a really, really important aspect of what we say yes to when we're pitched.
And to piggyback a little bit on this, tell me, like, you know, what are the types of things, like, you get an article from someone, and what I really like about The Athletic is, you know, I've sent articles to other sites that I've had the privilege to writing for, and then they just post it. And I have sometimes look at what my draft was compared to what was posted and see, okay, what do I need to change? Tell me a little bit, like, what are some of the factors that you look when you're changing? And do you see that as a big benefit for a writer to get, you know, the actual edits that are being done? And I also want to know, do you often get any pushback on what's edited, the suggestions that you make?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, as I'm sure you know, writers can be very possessive of their words, and they want their work to be well represented and have, you know, a say in the final product. So that's totally understandable. And sometimes there's a little debate on what's best for a piece. But ultimately, I mean, I think that's another unique aspect of The Athletic, is that we actually have the time to spend time on every individual piece. We're not just churning out content to get things out and to hit a quota or to, you know, keep the clicks coming. We want to give our subscribers the best possible content that we can with every single piece. So we really take the time to make every piece as strong as it can be. And that involves, you know, going through and doing more edits than a lot of other sites do. And we've heard from writers a lot that this is a unique system.
Excuse me.
And, you know, they don't get this other places. So most writers really appreciate that we take the time to invest in every piece and work with them to get their work as good as it possibly can be.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that. You know, what I like is, you know, obviously when we're in the middle of a transfer window, we have some things that are maybe a little bit more time sensitive, but there's been some other articles that we've worked on together where we've gone back and forth quite a lot. And, you know, those to me were like really good learning moments. So I enjoyed that. I think the recent one on Icardi felt like almost giving birth for me, but it was really good because I learned a ton on that. So you've already shared what I think is really great advice is, you know, try to be unique, try to find some things that are maybe underserved in the market, try to do things that nobody else is doing. But I want to ask you, if you were a young writer, and there's a lot of them listening to you right now on the podcast, you know, what type of advice would you give them? Because again, I think the landscape is pretty different than when you got started, but you're very plugged in to this. We live in an era where there's so many people willing to write for free and just pump out content and whatnot. So tell me a little bit in this environment, if you were working with an up and coming writer, what type of advice would you give them?
I mean, as I said before, be unique, find your own niche, something that people will be interested in, but is underserved currently. But beyond that, I think building up your own audience is really, really important right now. I think a lot of writers just starting out think that, okay, I'll sign with a big website or a big media outlet and they'll provide the audience for me. But more and more now, it's really attractive to come to the table with your own audience already. It's attractive to a lot of media companies right now. So if you can build your own audience either through social media or through your own website, or just, you know, start your own thing and build your voice, develop your voice, figure out what works for you, see what you get a response over, and just trial and error, just do it yourself. And then you'll be, I think, more prepared to make that jump to a major media outlet or a bigger website or, you know, something along those lines.
Very well said, because I can't begin to tell you, you know, how many people that, you know, are just getting started. They're like, hey, get me in touch with an editor at ESPN or get me in touch with an editor at The Athletic. And I'm like, well, you know, it took me years to get to that. So I think that's like really, really excellent advice. I think, you know, in a way, there's never been a better time, because as you said, there's so many avenues that you can post your work. You know, there's a lot of club sites that follow a team that are looking for writers. You can literally post things on WordPress. And I'm like a big believer that you can really build an audience that way. So Brooks, I can't thank you enough for coming on. It's been a pleasure working with you on the columns. It's been a pleasure to hear from you advice for our listeners. So thanks so much for being a guest on Couchland.
Thanks for having me, David. This was great.